This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. More than 150 individuals gathered in Charleston this week for a meeting that was the first of its kind. Hosted by the Catholic Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston, the day-long conference brought together the State Division of Juvenile Services, Department of Health and Human Resources, and the Department of Education with religious and community social service programs to focus on an issue that's becoming more and more visible in West Virginia: transitioning juveniles from state custody back into their communities. As Ashton Morrow reports, the conference was focused on addressing the issues within the system and finding ways to work together to fix them.
Nothing's going to hit me harder than that.
22-year-old Kanawha County resident Jimmy, who asked us not to use his last name, knows all too well what it's like to be a ward of the state. As a child, Jimmy was in and out of DHHR placements for nearly 10 years. Then, in 2011, at age 16, he was found guilty of a domestic battery charge and sent to the Salem Industrial Home for Youth, which at the time was one of the state's maximum security juvenile facilities.
Just when I thought I couldn't get any worse, I'd do something stupid and get even farther in a hole.
But Jimmy says at Salem, things started to change. He started to change.
Something has to click in your mind to make you want to change. And mine was, I don't like the way my life is. So I wanted it to change. You know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I had been doing that. I wish somebody would have told me that when I was 8, but at about 16, I realized that made sense.
Jimmy was sentenced to what insiders in the juvenile justice system call a flat. It's the maximum sentence for a crime with an ultimate release date. Jimmy's was January 31st, 2012. Whether he was ready or not, that's when he was to be released from state custody. But because of their living situations, Jimmy was not going to be released to his parents. Instead, he was expected to live on his own and begin providing for himself.
I was every day got more anxious and worried and nervous, and I didn't know how to feel because I had never lived by myself completely, other than in placement.
But he didn't have to prepare alone. Jimmy was assigned to one of the Division of Juvenile Services Community Resource Coordinators. Those coordinators work with DJS residents to find housing, jobs, and navigate state and federal aid programs. Jimmy was assigned to Julie Timmermeyer.
We as aftercare, I say we wear many hats. One is a mentor. One is sometimes a teacher type, you know, to show them. But a lot of times we're a parent.
After completing his GED and reaching his release date, Timmermeyer helped Jimmy apply for a grant through the Salvation Army to pay for his housing for the first 6 months of his release. Timmermeyer then helped him find an apartment, sign up for food stamps, look for a job, even buy a washer and dryer. Timmermeyer is one of just 12 community resource coordinators employed by DJS. Each is assigned a 5-county area and is responsible for helping juvenile residents from those counties transition out of their placements back into their communities. And that's what this week's day-long conference in Charleston was about, making the transition easier. More than 150 representatives of state, religious, and community groups gathered at the St. John the 23rd Pastoral Center to not just network, but discuss the challenges the system faces. Stephanie Bond is the director of the Division of Juvenile Services.
So today was a way to bring everybody together to network, to find out what sort of resources are available, as well as what do we still need? What's lacking out there?
What's lacking, most of the attendees say, is affordable housing, mental health or substance abuse services, and most of all, transportation. Angela Inglis is a community resource coordinator in Preston, Randolph, Tucker, Mineral, and Grant counties.
If you have a kid in Preston County, there really aren't a lot of resources there, but in Mon, you know, it's full of resources. Then you run into the kid can't get there. So transportation's an issue always.
The way to fix these problems, according to Iglesias, is additional funding. But she knows those state dollars are hard to come by. She and other conference attendees instead focused on working together to coordinate services, brainstorming ways to get the community involved in the transition process, and lobbying lawmakers about the importance of funding services at the local level. As for Jimmy, he and Timmermeyer's one-year assignment is complete, but they still keep in touch. Right now, she's helping Jimmy explore his options for secondary schooling. He says he likes history, science, and math, especially statistics and probabilities, but he's taking his time finding the best program for him and the best way to provide for his future. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
There are about 180 active AmeriCorps volunteers working in West Virginia. A new partnership between Volunteer West Virginia and the Red Cross is training many of these AmeriCorps to be ready to serve communities affected by disasters. And as Roxy Todd reports, some of these volunteers have already been deployed in the last few weeks to assist residents affected by flooding and mudslides.
We hear about disasters all the time on the news.
5 feet above flood stage, so almost 3 feet.
It's expected to be 10 to 30 degrees below normal across the region.
Flooding parts of West Virginia got up to about...
Homes were damaged and people were displaced because of mudslides, snowstorms, and flooding.
With temperatures rising, the snow is melting fast, causing floods along rivers and creeks.
And many of us would like to help, but we don't. For lack of time, skills, or guts. But that didn't stop Kristen Shinneberry, who's originally from Pocahontas County.
I have experience because I was, you know, grew up on like in a farming area and that type of thing, so I'm not new to like hands-on stuff.
When the call came asking for volunteers to travel down to icy Mingo County, she said yes, even though she was apprehensive that she didn't have enough carpentry skills.
I really don't know how to like build or repair anything.
Another Disaster Corps volunteer, Jameel Jackson, says she was very thankful for the on-the-job training she got by working alongside the more seasoned relief workers.
So I'm like tugging at a hammer, like trying to pull it out, and I'm not doing it right. And they're like, well, no, lean it against the wall and pull back. And so like it was just, they were super awesome, and it was a lot easier than expected.
Jackson is originally from Detroit, Michigan, where there's no shortage of need for assistance. But she says communities in Detroit are not used to the type of flooding people in southern West Virginia see. Another Disaster Corps volunteer, Beckley native Toria Cummings, says she was stunned by the effects of those floods in Mingo County.
It was exciting and sad all at the same time to see the devastation that they had suffered. Even the little things we take for granted, like sliding your shoes on just walking out the house, they had to leave without their shoes. And I mean, it's like, what, minus 11, minus 10?
Stephanie Yu is the executive director of Volunteer West Virginia, and she explains that the Disaster Corps program came about partly in response to last year's water crisis in Kanawha County.
There was sort of this idea that we needed to have infrastructure so that when things like that happen, we could have people ready to go.
When there isn't a disaster, these AmeriCorps will continue to work on their other projects, like tutoring children or helping veterans. Toria Cummings admits leaving the community after aiding in flood relief in the short term felt a little bit strange, almost like she was abandoning them.
It was difficult to leave them knowing I'm going home and you have to either stay here in this hotel or you're going to have to find family members that can take you in or just totally rebuild. You know, that's got to be hard.
A week after she returned from Mingo County, Cummings was deployed to Kanawha County to help residents displaced from the Yeager Airport landslide. Some residents there are still evacuated from their homes in the area directly affected by the slide, Keystone Drive, while others are in the process of deciding to stay in the area or sell their homes and move away. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
Governor Tomlin says the Federal Emergency Management Agency has approved his request for a disaster declaration in West Virginia after that severe storm in early March. Tomlin says the declaration will provide assistance for emergency work and the repair or replacement of facilities damaged in the storm, which rolled through the state on March 4th and 5th. The declaration makes public assistance available to 29 counties for infrastructure and cleanup efforts. That storm brought heavy snow and rain, knocked out power to more than 80,000 customers, and caused that flooding, landslides, and mudslides. This is West Virginia Morning at 7:53. Sunshine today with highs in the mid-50s to the mid-60s. Clear skies tonight with lows in the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Increasing cloudiness tomorrow. Windy with a chance of scattered rain late in the day. Highs tomorrow in the 60s to low 70s. The outlook for Thursday night and Friday, mostly cloudy and breezy with a 50-50 chance of rain and thunderstorms. Lows tomorrow night in the 50s, highs Friday in the 60s.
Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is provided by State Electric Supply Company. West Virginia's total electric solution, online at stateelectric.com. And from WVU Arts and Entertainment, presenting Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn at the WVU Creative Arts Center, April 9th. Information at 304-293-SHOW.
A somewhat mysterious Morgantown landmark was opened up to the public recently. The Calvary Chapel Church is renovating Pietro's Castle. And as Jesse Wright reports, more than 300 people got to see the results for themselves.
Italian immigrant and stonemason Tony Pietro earned his slice of the American dream by building infrastructure across the region, from Mingo County to Pittsburgh. When he retired in 1928, he built a three-story, 23-room home for his family that reflected his strong Catholic faith, complete with a large cross sitting between two soaring parapets.
It was always one of those places that you kind of used as a landmark.
Drew Rubenstein grew up and went to middle school near the property on Tyrone Road.
Driving to school would always be just one of the things that you'd always look out outside the window just because it stands out so much in the Cheat Lake area.
Rubenstein, like many people who grew up in Morgantown, came to know the property as the Friary. That's because in 1949, Pietro gave his unique home and 32 acres to the Franciscan Brothers of the Catholic Church to be used as a monastery. When the man who ran the monastery, Father Jude Milley, died in 2007, the property sat vacant until Calvary Chapel Church of Morgantown bought it 5 years later. Pastor Sean Frazier leads the non-denominational congregation. He says he was looking for a new place for his quickly expanding flock and saw a lot of potential in the friary.
So we have been actively renovating this structure, the castle structure, for the last year and a half. All the plumbing, all the electrical, the restoring it to usefulness.
Realizing that the surrounding community was curious about what was going on at the castle, Frazier decided to hold an open house this past weekend.
This house has really been shrouded in a lot of secrecy. I mean, there's been people that have lived across the way and have never been inside. And so we wanted to open up and to show what we've done, the stewardship that we've shared. But we also want people to see the beauty of it and what God is doing here.
Claudia Harmon and her husband Don are from Preston County. They were among the hundreds of people who toured the castle on Saturday.
I wasn't disappointed. No, it was really nice. Craftsmanship was pretty amazing.
Morgantown resident Sean Bocan visited the castle when Father Jude was in charge. He says he likes that another church has taken ownership of the iconic space.
It's good to see a reuse, and still, from what I believe in Mr. Pietro's vision of being a ministry to the community.
Rubenstein and his wife, Brittany, joined the Calvary congregation about 4 years ago. He says members of the church are excited to be part of the castle's continuing religious legacy.
There's not a piece of the church that's not being used for something. It's not like, hey, we got it and that's good enough. It's all about, you know, trying to use it for God's work and to make the most of it.
Frazier says the castle will be used as a parsonage where he and his family will live. It also will be used to hold prayer meetings and Bible study. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jesse Wright in Morgantown.
And you can see photos of the castle on our website, wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on that website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Chuck Anzalevich. I'm Beth Voorhees.